is on page 593. O Lord, you have always been our home. Before you created the hills or brought the world into being, you were eternally God, and you will be God forever. You tell us to return to what we were. You change us back to dust. 1,000 years to you are like one day. They're like yesterday already gone. Like a short hour in the night, you carry us away like a flood. We last no longer than a dream. We are like weeds that sprout in the morning, that grow and burst into bloom, and then dry up and die in the evening. We are destroyed by your anger. We are terrified by your fury. You place our sins before you, our secret sins, where you can see them. Our life is cut short by your anger. It fades away like a whisper. 70 years is all we have. 80 years if we are strong. Yet all they bring us is trouble and sorrow. Life is soon over and we are gone. Who has felt the full power of your anger? Who knows what fear your fury can bring? Teach us how short our life is, so that we may become wise. How much longer will your anger last? Have pity, O Lord, on your servants. Fill us each morning with your constant love, so that we may sing and be glad all of our life. Give us now as much happiness as the sadness you gave us during all of our years of misery. Let us, your servants, see your mighty deeds. Let our descendants see your glorious might. Lord, our God, may your blessings be with us. Give us success in all we do. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Well, time. Everything that we do nowadays is governed by time. Now, if I was to ask you what time it was without you looking at your watches, I reckon you could probably have a fair guess as to the time our service is now. Because our service starts at a particular time and finishes roughly at the same sort of time each week. When we go to the dentist, our opticians or the hairdressers, we are given a timed appointment. Public transport runs on timetables. We have general times as to when we get up and when we eat and when we return to our beds. And we appear to be obsessed with time. We wear watches or carry mobile phones around us as a constant reminder of what the time is. Walls of public buildings are adorned with clocks. Inside our own houses, we have a constant reminder of what the time is. Again, wall clocks or diaries or the cooker or the microwave, the TV, our central heating system, our computers, our iPads. And if all those clues fail us, what can we often hear ourselves asking? What time is it? And then comes our analysis. If I have time, I will do this or I will do that. Oh gosh, is that the time? I'm running out of time. How much time have I got? You see, for us to be asking the question, what time is it? How much time do I have? The question becomes a constant reminder that time is very elusive. It's like trying to catch water in our hands. It just flows through them. A month ago, I called the ambulance for my mother and we dashed up to Hemel Hempstead to be with her in the hospital. Everyone could see that she was seriously ill and deteriorating. And I found myself constantly asking the paramedics and the doctors and the nurses over the next 2 weeks, 3 weeks or so, how much time have we got? 2 weeks ago, on the 1st of February, she passed away, and tomorrow we cremate her. We may even ask the question ourselves, how much time do I have? But surely that's asking the wrong question. Rather than asking how much time, we should be asking ourselves, what am I doing with my time? Am I using it wisely? None of us know how much time we have left to live. Time is just a measurement to help us plan and to organize our lives. How much time we have, well, is generally outside of our control. One day we may be here, fit and healthy, and the next minute run over by a bus. We have become so sophisticated in our daily living, so powerful in our understanding, so much so that we think that we can control our destiny, everything in life. And we sometimes think that we can control time as well. But the reality is that we cannot control it. It's not how much time have I got left, which is the all-important question, but what am I doing with my time? Am I using my time wisely? The ancient Greeks had two words for time, chronos and kairos. Chronos is where we get our word chronological or sequential time. Kairos is a proper or an opportune time for action. And we're so caught up in chronos time in our day-to-day living that perhaps we are dead to this other type of time, kairos, a proper and an opportune time. So today I'd like us to focus our minds on kairos time through the lens of Psalm 90, which we heard earlier. Now, Psalm 90 is the only psalm, as far as scholars are aware, that was reputedly written by Moses. And it was a prayer from the wilderness. As we know, Moses had been chosen to lead the people of God out of Egypt back to the promised land, promised to them by God. But as they journeyed, they wandered around and around and around in circles for 40 long years in the desert. And Moses came to see the futility of life. The people of God, like us, were on a treadmill. Over the years, through the journeying in the desert, people were dying. They had little to show for their life of action. It was as if they were heading downstream in a tiny little boat with no paddle, no motor. Maybe a rudder to occasionally steer by. But however much they might try, they could not change the overall direction of their journey. They had to go with the flow of the water, or time, as we might call it, regardless of their actions. Maybe Moses was getting overwhelmed by the feeling that life was just futile. Ultimately, what is it for? We may have found the same feelings and questions in our own times of life. What is the purpose of life? What is the purpose of my life? And if we're not careful, cynicism and despair may take hold of us. because we surmise that actually there is no real explanation, no real reason as to our existence at all. Life is futile. We live and we die, and there is little that we can achieve that is gained from it. And it suddenly dawned on Moses, our life does not start with our birth and our death, as we often think of it. That picture is far too narrow. So Moses starts his prayer of Psalm 90 with the words, Lord, you have been our dwelling place throughout all generations. Before the mountains were born, or you brought them forth from the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. The bookends of life and death are not the sum of our lives at all. You, O Lord, have been our dwelling place from before the world was, and you are the dwelling place for all eternity, from everlasting through to everlasting. God is not limited, and he's certainly not controlled by time. He lives both in and outside of time. And that is the context of the setting of your life and mine. Our life does not start with our birth, and it does not end with our death here on earth. That's just a small part of this eternal living of which we were created. Because life is not all about us, as much as we might think or believe it is. We are not the center of the universe. Not everything is revolving around us. It's not about us. It's all about God. From everlasting to everlasting, you are God. What we consider as life, life on this planet, the fragileness of the human form, with all of its joys and its sorrows, its ups and its downs, its labours and its pleasures, has its real purpose and meaning not in us, but ultimately in and for God. Our days, in our eyes, are a fleeting glimpse in God's. 1,000 earth years are like a day in God's. Now, the agnostic is right to think that life apart from God is indeed futile. We earn and we save our wealth and we have a good time, but when the time comes, well, we can't take that wealth with us. None of those riches that we've gathered and stored up. And so we wither and we die with little to show for it. Many people seek fame and fortune in life, but learn that in reality, nothing satisfies, not deep down. So for the agnostic, life is futile, it is pointless. Moses said, you turn people back to dust, saying, return to dust, you mortals, yet you sweep people away in the sleep of death. They are like the new grass in the morning. In the morning it springs up new, but in the evening it is dry and withered. That's been said that there are two certain things in life, taxes and death. Well, we know from experience from our television programs and the newspapers that some people can get away with taxes, so we know that one's not true. But the other one is. In fact, statisticians have calculated, I'm not too sure how long they spent doing this, but statisticians have calculated that one out of one people die. Isn't that amazing? There is no way of getting around that statistic or certainty of life. And one of the most famous things that this psalmist is known for is his declaration of lifespan, 80 years in the Authorized Version, or 80 years if we are lucky. Now, I know that some of us are more aged more than that. We're not to take this literally, to get our head up and think of this as a literal statement of our allotted time span on earth. This language is poetical and so should be seen as symbolic, symbolizing not 70 years or 80 years or 82 years or 85 years, but symbolizing the shortness and fragility of the human form compared to the everlasting nature of God's. Yet through this earthly life, we will see times of happiness and joy, as well as sadness and sorrow. We will sense of achievement, of a job well done, as well as pain and discomfort or hardship, and for some people in the world, even persecution. Moses says, our days may come to 70 years or 80 if our strength endures, yet the best of them are but trouble and sorrow, for they quickly pass and we fly away. Life can indeed be a struggle sometimes for the best of us. And we may ask the question, why? Why them? Why me? Why is there all this suffering? Why is there all this pain? Why is there death? And certainly when we're in the thick of it, we may think that our situation and our predicament is endless and life is a constant struggle and we just want to get out. We want things to get back to normal again. We want life to improve. We desire our life to improve again. But let us remember where Moses started in his prayer. He didn't start with him and his situation wandering aimlessly in the desert, seeing people that he knew and traveled with dying over those 40 years in this relentless wilderness and sun bearing down on them with all the hardships of life that they endured. No, his focus was not on them and it was not on him, but it was on the Lord. Now, if you've ever studied any of the Psalms, you may have realized that this is quite unusual. According to Old Testament scholars, the book of Psalms contains a variety of different types of writings. So we have Psalms of thanksgiving. We have Psalms of wisdom. Psalms about enthronements concerning the king and so on. But do you know what the most common type of psalm is? The most common type is of lament. The most frequent psalms that we find in our Bibles are those complaining to God. But not so with this psalm, Psalm 90. Moses lifts his eyes away from himself and sees his life and his situation in the context of the fragility of life compared to God, who was and is to come. His life may indeed be mortal with a specific span to it, but God is a God who is from everlasting to everlasting. With him, in the middle of it. For the agnostic, if life is all there is, then it is useless. It is futile. There is no purpose. There is no meaning. We are born, we live, we die, and that's it. Most of us will live on in the memories of our loved ones, but they will come to die, and their memories of us will die with them. But for the people of faith, life is neither useless nor futile. Our lives have real meaning because God himself brings that meaning, brings that purpose to life itself. What we do in life and how we live our lives day to day has a direct consequence on the kingdom of God here on earth. Not just now, but for all eternity. No matter how much we would love to be at the center of the universe, that's not the issue. God is at the center of the universe. The world does not revolve around us as much as we might like to think it does. The world revolves around God, his creation. God made it and he sustains it for his purposes. And what we do with our lives has a direct eternal consequence. Because what we do and how we do live and how we live our lives transcends this mortal life in which we live. Teach us, says Moses, to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Now, true wisdom can only be found in God. It's not something that you can make or create. We can't go onto our smartphones and download an app of how to get wisdom. We can't go to university or college and be taught wisdom. We can't go into the bookshops and buy books and learn it as if it was an academic exercise to partake in. We can't join a club or a group that we may take a subscription in order to get wisdom or be wise. Socrates once said, "The only true wisdom is in knowing you know nothing." The only true wisdom is in knowing you know nothing. And Psalm 111 says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom." Wisdom is not about what we know about ourselves, but actually what we know about God. True wisdom is an attitude of heart which ultimately is in tune with God's heart. For true wisdom comes from God himself. James, in his letter, pastoral letter in the New Testament, says this: "If you are wise and understand God's ways, prove it by living an honorable life, doing good works with the humility that comes from wisdom. But if you are bitterly jealous and there is selfish ambition in your heart, don't cover up the truth with boasting and lies. For jealousy and selfishness are not God's kind of wisdom. Such things are earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. For wherever there is jealousy and selfish ambition, there you will find disorder and evil of every kind. But the wisdom from above is first of all pure. It is also peace, loving, gentle at all times, and willing to yield to others. It is full of mercy and the fruits of good deeds. It shows no favoritism and is always sincere. And those who are peacemakers will plant seeds of peace and reap a harvest of righteousness." That comes from James chapter 3. Do you recall that parable that Jesus told of the servants and their talents? The gifts, the skills, the abilities are not meant to be buried in the ground, but are to be used profitably, not for themselves, but for their master on his return. The gifts and the skills and the abilities God gives and invests in us should likewise be used not for our pleasing and our pleasure, which is our folly, but for God and for the furtherance of his kingdom. Abraham Lincoln once remarked, "In the end, it's not the years in your life that count, it's the life in your years." It's all about how we live our life, and not how long we live it. For in the end, our mortal life on this planet is indeed insignificant in the light of God's eternity. If God is your dwelling place, then whatever you do for his glory. Even the most mundane of tasks takes on a new significance when you belong to God. Our fleeting lives can indeed have value if we live wisely before this eternal God. Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote in 1865, "The bitterest tears shed over graves are for words left unsaid and for deeds left undone." Let's be honest with ourselves. Could that be our epitaph? Could that be said of you and of me? Could it be true? That the bitterest tears shed over graves are for words left unsaid and deeds left undone. I pray that that may not be our epitaph, and especially not before God. But instead, as we approach his glory, when the time comes for us to go into his everlasting arms, that those will not be the words, but "well done, good and faithful servant."